Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. The Morningstar Investment Conference for investment professionals will be held virtually this year on September 16th and 17th. We're offering the same research, analysis, and insight for investment professionals you'd get at the live event for a reduced price of $149. And the best part is you could join us from wherever you are. For more information or to register, visit go.morningstar.com/MIC. Again, that website is go.morningstar.com/MIC. In this week's podcast, Dan Lefkowitz finds opportunities for equity income investors, Christine Benz helps young investors avoid pitfalls, Amy Arnott shares trends in U.S. investor returns, and Russ Kinnell uncovers tips for navigating bear markets. Let's get started. Holly Black of Morningstar UK speaks with Dan Lefkowitz of Morningstar's Indexes.
Welcome to Morningstar. I'm Holly Black. With me is Dan Lefkowitz. He's a strategist at Morningstar in Chicago. Hello.
Hello, Holly.
So I think dividends have been on the minds of a lot of investors this year, mostly because they keep getting cut. But you've done some research and you're saying it's not such a bad time to be an income investor after all.
You know, Holly, it's undeniably been a difficult year for equity income investors around the globe. We've seen some big dividend stalwarts cut their dividends. Royal Dutch Shell lowered its dividend payment for the first time since World War II. In Australia, three of the big four banks cut their dividends. Some blue chip names in the U.S. market like Disney and Boeing. But plenty of companies have maintained their dividends, and that doesn't make the headlines. You know, bad news is always a better story than good news. And if we look globally at equity markets, we see plenty of healthy, even rising shareholder payouts. The pain has really been felt most acutely by the areas that are most exposed to the pandemic-related shutdowns and economic slowdowns. So travel and leisure, the airlines, consumer discretionary, oil and gas, and basic materials have been an area that's been hit hard by dividend cuts. In the U.S. market, small caps have really borne a big brunt of the blow.
So you run these indices that specifically pick out companies that are still growing their dividends. So if they cut, they're out. So you must be fully aware of the areas of resilience. So what sort of sectors are holding up better this year?
Yeah, so when we did some index rebalancing in June, there were indeed a number of dividend payers that had to be removed from these indexes because the companies indicated suspensions of the dividends, largely in the areas that I mentioned. But it wasn't major upheaval. The turnover wasn't excessive. And there are definitely plenty of areas where we are finding healthy payouts. So I'd point to consumer staples as opposed to consumer discretionary. So more defensive names like Procter & Gamble and Costco, Nestle and Danone, Kao in Japan. Healthcare and technology, which are two areas that are not necessarily known for being dividend rich, but in big pharma, we see some healthy dividends, Bristol-Myers, Sanofi, Novartis. Within technology, Microsoft and Cisco, ASML, SAP, Taiwan Semi, industrials names like 3M and ABB, and then financials, which has been an area where we've seen plenty of dividend cuts, many of them mandated by regulators as a condition of aid. Our dividend indexes they seem to favor the Canadian banks, JP Morgan, the credit card companies like Visa and MasterCard. And all of these companies that I'm citing are ones that Morningstar equity analysts believe have economic moats or sustainable competitive advantages that should allow them to sustain profitability and dividends as well.
Okay, you're right. When you say it like that and list all those companies, it doesn't sound so bad. So for any investors that are still panicking about their income and the dividend cuts, what would be some words of advice for them?
Yeah, well, we'd be leery of the highest yielders in the market. Those are often companies that are in financial distress. They're dividend traps in many cases. The dividend might not be sustainable, and you can end up sacrificing long-term total return at the expense of short-term income. And then we'd tell investors not to get too hung up on dividend history. As Shell showed us this year, you know, a decades-long track record can only get you so far. We'd look instead for factors that we think are predictive of dividends sustainability and dividend dividend growth going forward. And dividend growth can be the sign of healthy and improving corporate fundamentals.
Yeah, I do love that point of it doesn't matter if this company has paid a dividend for 50 years. It didn't this year. So find one that is. And you've found there are plenty of options for people.
Right.
Dan, thank you so much for your time. For Morningstar, I'm Holly Black.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit morningstar.com/Alexa.
Now, Susan Jubinski and Christine Benz of Morningstar Inc. explain why young investors should avoid investing directly in stocks.
Hi, I'm Susan Jubinski with Morningstar. One phenomenon we're experiencing during the pandemic is seeing more young people investing directly in stocks. But is that a good idea? Joining me today to discuss is Christine Benz. Christine is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance. Christine, thanks for joining me today.
Susan, it's great to be here.
So, you know, we've seen a lot of reports in the media about how young people are dabbling in stocks today. First, you know, can we really call this a trend? And secondly, what do you think is behind it if it is a trend?
It's hard to say, Susan. I looked for some quantification of the trend that we've been hearing so much about. There has been an indication among some of the brokerage platforms that they've been seeing a lot of new account applications. They began seeing them in the early part of this pandemic. So that's one indication. Robinhood has certainly taken off as a platform for younger investors. That's a free trading application. And I think that you could probably chalk it up to a few different factors. One is that most of us have some extra time on our hands, so it could be that. It could be that not having other forces competing for our spending has given younger folks some discretionary cash. And it's also worth noting that some of the apps like Robinhood have done a good job of kind of gamifying investing in the market. So they've made it fun, they've made it playful. So I think it's probably engaged some young investors on that level. And then we saw this really dramatic market action in the first half of 2020, where we had a dramatic sell-off and then really almost immediate gratification after that period. And so perhaps younger investors were intrigued by that idea of I can buy X really cheaply and see it recover very quickly. So I think it's a confluence of factors.
So if you're a young person who's new to investing, you know, from your point of view, is it really a good idea to start by investing in individual stocks?
I've really wrestled with this, Susan. I tweeted like a month ago that I think it's actually a suboptimal way for young investors to get started. And I received a lot of pushback, actually. People I really respect said, well, this is the way that I learned how to invest. This is the way I learned how stocks and the market work. And I appreciate that perspective. But I guess my counterpoint is, if you're young, if you're, say, you're in your 20s or something like that, we've all seen the charts about how impactful compounding can be if you get started early. So my thought is that while young investors have that long runway, if they can get started in assets that can really give them a good shot at appreciation, so if they can invest in a diversified broad basket of equities, that probably gives them a better runway to earn good long-term returns over their very long time horizon. So my advice would be to skip the individual stock investing and move straight to a broad basket, maybe an index fund or a target date fund.
What else then? So if we're talking about index funds and target date funds, you know, what else should young investors be keeping in mind as they're first going out into the market?
Well, I think they would want to keep in mind short-term goals, because many of these young investors certainly are not investing for retirement. They're investing for new home purchases, buying a car, whatever it might be. And so I think, you know, if you're working with a young person in your life, if you're talking to them about how to get started in investing, make sure that they understand the importance of segregating money used for short-term goals in something safer than stocks. stocks, maybe talk to them a little bit about this sort of bucketing concept, if you will. And I think it's also important to talk to young folks who have a salary about the virtue of using some tax-sheltered investment vehicle to do their saving. If they're employed and they have a workplace plan, they may have a 401k match. If they're not offered a workplace plan, anyone with earned income can do a Roth IRA up to the amount of earned income. So talk to them about the value of using some of those tax-sheltered receptacles. And also talk to them about the value of having that rainy day fund. Because one thing we've seen through this crisis is that people really struggle with this, with setting aside liquid reserves to tide them through disruptions in their income or emergency spending that they might have to do. So I think, if you have someone near and dear to you, explain to them the virtue of making sure that you have those short-term reserves on hand.
So speaking of, let's say you are a more seasoned investor and you do have someone near and dear to you who's younger, who has caught the investing bug, and you want to help out, what resources would you recommend for that seasoned investor?
Great question, Susan. And so one thing I would say is help them graduate from Reddit, where a lot of younger investors seem to be getting their information. Morningstar.com, obviously, I think is a fantastic resource. Bogleheads is a fantastic resource for investors of all ages. And I would also recommend a couple of books. I love the Bogleheads Guide to Investing. It's not new, but I think there's a lot of great evergreen information there. One book I like for younger investors is I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. And that's just a terrific book about the importance of saving, the importance of frugality. And that ties in a lot of ways with the FIRE movement, which I think in a lot of ways is a healthier thing for young investors to think about, to really understand the importance of personal savings, of saving as much of your income as you possibly can. So I think that some of the FIRE blogs can be really helpful in that context as well, as sort of a counterpoint to the day trading mentality that seems to be taking hold in some younger investor communities.
Well, it's interesting because, at Morningstar, we're big advocates of getting started early and letting compounding work for you. But, day trading is probably not the way to do it.
No, it reminds me, Susan, of so much of the early 2000s, late 90s period where everyone had to have a brokerage account and many investors had predictably awful results because they were just performance chasing. They were chasing Cisco and the latest dot-com stock, and many investors did not end up being successful with those positions. So I think starting broadly diversified makes a world of sense for young investors.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for the perspective today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next, Susan Jabinski talks with Amy Arnott of Morningstar Research Services.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. We recently updated our annual study of U.S. investor returns. And here today to talk about some of the key takeaways is Amy Arnott. Amy's a portfolio strategist at Morningstar. Amy, thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Amy, before we dig into the results, can you talk a little bit about investor returns and why Morningstar looks at them every year?
Sure. So an investor return is basically the return that you would actually earn after adjusting for cash inflows and outflows into a fund. And in almost every case, the return you actually earn is going to be different from a fund's total return. The fund's reported total return assumes that you took a lump sum and invested it at the beginning of the period and held it throughout the entire time period. But most investors, they are investing in 401k plans or investing gradually over time. So we look at the difference between the actual results and the reported total returns to see how big those gaps are over time.
Now, it seems like we've seen over time some improvement in these investor returns. Let's talk a little bit about the trends over time.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a positive trend. Looking back over the past 5 years, if you go back 5 years ago, investors were losing about 60 basis points on average, because of the timing of their cash flows. And we've really seen that gap narrow significantly, so that for this most recent period ending in 2019, investor returns overall were almost exactly in line with the reported total returns.
Wow. Wow. And it also seems like one finding we've seen is that in general, investors in those categories with the most assets have had pretty narrow gaps in investor returns. And that seems like a good thing.
That's right. Yeah. So we saw the best results for category groups like U.S. equity funds and allocation funds, which invest in a mix of stocks and bonds. And those are also areas that have the most investor assets. So that has also helped the overall results.
But there's still probably areas, right, where investors aren't doing as well and maybe investing a little poorly from a timing perspective. What are those pockets?
So some of the problem spots that we continued to see were in category groups like sector equity funds and alternatives, which tend to be much more difficult to use. We've also seen a pattern there where investors tend to kind of pile in after a period of strong performance and then head for the exits after things turn south. So definitely some areas that seem to be more difficult for investors to use effectively.
Now, for the first time this year, we took dollar cost averaging into account in the study. Specifically, we wanted to see how returns would look if there was a consistent monthly inflow into funds. So what did you see there, and what's sort of the key takeaway there for an investor?
So the dollar cost averaging results really reinforced the overall results we saw. And the pattern was for areas that had positive investor returns, investors would have actually done worse taking a dollar cost averaging approach. And on the flip side, areas where investor return gaps were more negative would have done better if investors had just invested a little bit at a time.
So then, given those results and everything we've seen in the study, you know, what are the key messages for investors from this research? It sounds like they're not behaving that badly across the board.
Right, right. And, you know, there are a lot of different factors that go into the numbers. So a lot of it depends on what's the pattern of returns that you're experiencing and how does that match up with your investment patterns. But overall, we don't, you know, aside from a few problem spots, we don't see a lot of evidence that there's widespread market timing or that the majority of investors are misusing funds and not getting good results. So overall, you know, we saw that the results were pretty good.
Well, then that's terrific news. That's what we want, investors to be making the right decisions with their money. So Amy, thank you for your time today and helping unpack these results for us.
Sure. It's great to be here.
I'm Susan Chubinsky with Morningstar. Thanks for tuning in.
And lastly, Russ Kinnell of Morningstar Research Services interviews Charlie Dreyfus of Royce Investment Partners.
Hi, I'm Russ Kinnell, Director of Manager Research for Morningstar. I'm very happy today to be joined remotely by Charlie Dreyfus, a longtime manager of Royce Special Equity. Charlie inhabits the unfashionable corner of the style box, small value, and he's done so for a long time. Been through three bear markets at this fund and performed very well in all three of those. So I thought this was a good time to check in with Charlie. Charlie, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak with you, Russ. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. So maybe before we get into investing brass tacks, I'm just curious, sort of, how has the pandemic affected your work in terms of are you working at home? How has it changed the way you collaborate and the way you place orders? How is that working out for you?
Good question, and you know, one that has positives and negatives. Actually, I live in Manhattan. I live walking distance from the office. So I'm working remotely, but I have been back to the office occasionally to pick up things and drop things off. The thing that I miss the most, and that is has always been so exciting about this business, is that you can continue to learn no matter how long you've been in it, is that dynamic of the exchange of ideas with, you know, your colleagues and others. And yes, we can do it via technology or phone, but it's not the same, you know, and you're also missing those spontaneous discussions, you know, the old notion of around the water cooler kind of concept. So it's working fine. Our firm is planning on allowing people to start coming back a little after Labor Day. And I intend on doing that. But the actual work, it's interesting. I love what I do. You know, take a quote from Buffett, I dance to work. And I've always worked, what I considered, full day. I'd get to the office at 7 or before in the morning, and I'd leave shortly after the close. These days, because I'm working from home, I start the day literally on the computer at 6, and I end the day generally around 5:30 or 6. So I'm actually, interestingly enough, working more hours from home. It also, I'm printing out my own documents. I've been a bonanza to Staples in terms of ordering office supplies. At the office, I have my assistant who prints out my 10Ks and 10Qs and all of that. And so here I'm doing some of that as well. But it's working. I mean, technology is such these days that you don't miss a beat, really.
Sure. So then I did want to get into this market environment. Your fund has performed much better than its peers in all three of the last, the three major bear markets, counting 2000, 08, and today. And so I'm curious, what is it about your strategy and the kind of companies you own that has enabled them to hold up in what are really three fairly different bear markets?
Yes. And actually, I think, as you know, Russ, I've been applying this strategy for now 40 years. It started with the Quest for Value Fund at Oppenheimer in May of 1980, and then transitioned to Lazard Special Equity Fund. And now for 22 years, it's been the Roy Special Equity Fund. So there's a long history of the kind of performance that you describe. Of course, the counter measure is that it underperforms generally on the upside. But indeed, we win by losing less, essentially. And the way we attain that is a very disciplined, some have called it rigid, and I plead guilty. I don't distinguish between disciplined and rigid. It's worked. It's based on the laws of economics and accounting. So what we're looking for are companies that are absolutely inexpensive so that they stand up as a business. We would all buy the company because we would earn a return higher than it would cost us to finance the acquisition of that company. And my observation through not only the past three bear markets that you mentioned, but going back the entire 40 years, is that when you buy absolute value, it doesn't get harmed as much, or in some cases harmed at all, when the market loses its bearings as to what the proper multiple should be. So absolute value, but good companies, avoiding what Buffett had said to Ben Graham, you bought cigar butts, because you can buy companies that are absolutely inexpensive, but they have a blemish in their business model. So I try to combine that absolute inexpensiveness with a high return on invested capital, low leverage, and a high cash conversion, meaning that they, what they report in earnings, they actually produce in cash. Now, all of this is aided the same principle that I use to distinguish whether a stock is absolutely inexpensive gives me a very good map as to where the market stands. So what happens at times, so right now it's very popular to say, don't fight the Fed because we have this expansive monetary situation. What I am now saying is don't fight the screens. The screens themselves are saying nothing's out there inexpensive to replenish the portfolio with. And quite the contrary, some of the names I own have gotten expensive enough that I should start selling them and possibly, if they go higher, reduce them. So there is an ebb and flow to the cash level in special equity, but it's a self-governing. It's not Charlie Dreyfus making a market call. It's what the market is telling me based on the valuation and the attractiveness. And what I should also add is that return to the buyers, I use the term cap rate, similar to in real estate. When the investor buys a parcel of real estate, you get a cap rate, a return. So we have that. That moves down as the stock price moves up. And depending on where the interest rates have moved, you may be raising the separation, in which case you're finding names. But if the separation between the cap rate and the cost of borrowing is narrowing, that's a time to raise cash. And that has successfully helped me do what, you know, we were all told to do, you know, sell high and buy low. And it really works.
So I'm curious, how did that work out in March and April when stocks were briefly very cheap, or by some standards anyway, but at least cheaper than they've been for a while? How did that process work? Did you find some new names?
Yes. So I thought you might ask that. So I have the statistics. To give you a sense, what happened was that on the end of the year, on December 31st, I had 12.7% in cash. Special equity generally has 8 to 10% in cash, more or less as a base. So the 12.7 was already elevated. On March 31st, it got as high. I actually, by February already, it was 16. And it peaked, or I should say at the end of, it peaked at 16.9 at the end of February, the cash position. And it went down in April to 13.6. So I spent cash. There's the constant ebb and flow as this works. The problem is now, obviously, the market has come back with a vengeance, and there's nothing that I can find that looks attractive. And frankly, I've been raising cash again. And there's a very long history. This, as an example, you may recall, if I may, the classic example of that spread narrowing, if we go back to 2018, we had a very robust market. And starting in the summer, the Federal Reserve started raising rates, something unheard of these days. So the market was expensive. So on the the end of, June 30th of 18, I had 12.6% in cash. Over the summer, by September, I had 18.6. Again, that was even more dramatic because prices rose, but interest rates rose. So you squashed that differential. But then by the end of the year, cash was down to 9.3. If you remember, that was a Christmas Eve sell-off, the likes of which we hadn't seen in a long time. And I was, I learned a long time ago, you can't buy cheap stocks with other cheap stocks. It's best to have cash. And I'm not suggesting that I'm a market timer, but the system itself, it self-governs the amount of cash based on the attractiveness of the market and individual stocks.
And something else I wanted to ask you about is one of the reasons, obviously, the last decade that growth has outperformed value significantly is that Google and Amazon are out there eating the lunch of a lot of value companies. Obviously, retailers are maybe the most prominent example, but they're not the only ones. So, of course, that means, in other words, there are a lot of value traps out there who may not see their business continue the way, and therefore, obviously, past earnings are not so helpful. So how do you factor that in to your work?
It's a great question, and retailers in particular were names that I sort of grew up with. Earlier in my career, I was initially a special situations analyst and covered a lot of retailers. In the late 60s and early 70s, when the notion of same-store sales was a new concept. And so over the years, I had made a lot of money and thought I knew retailers, but something dramatically changed, you know, in terms of the disruption. So these days, I have very little exposure. And on the broader issue of value traps, and that's very important, and I said one way is to screen not only for inexpensive, but for high returns on invested capital, suggesting some kind of moat and pricing power. But my colleague, Steve McBoyle, plays devil's advocate. So what he does, before we buy a name, one of his main roles, indeed, is to tear apart the idea, obviously, he's younger and has a better sense of technology than I do. So we examine every company for essentially what Buffett termed, you know, the Amazon effect. It's just disruption. Because businesses in general, business models, and we see it, you open the newspaper every day, and yes, it's mainly retailers, but the bankruptcies and closings of corporations, many of whom have been around forever, Lord and Taylor goes back to 1842. One has to be very mindful of that. And knock wood, I haven't had any of those in recent times. And part of that was also reducing. We had, as recently as probably 3-4 years ago, a significant portion of the portfolio in retailing. We still have a lot of consumer discretionary, but it's auto replacement tires. It's auto parts, replacement parts. It's other things. And even there, we are mindful of people who sell auto parts and tires online and what's happening in the various channels. So and again, this goes back to something I mentioned initially in terms of the beauty of this business and what keeps it so exciting is things change. And you continue to learn new ways of looking at things as compared to the way you used to.
Well, Charlie, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us. This has been really great. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. And as always, thank you and everyone at Morningstar. I appreciate your coverage and your support over many years.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Russ Kennel.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you've enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.